Connecticut Democrats, or Connecticrats, as they have never been called.
Welcome back to Connecticrats, the CT Dems podcast. I'm David Kostek.
I'm Tara Kamen.
And I'm Danny Cruz.
We're with the Connecticut Democratic Party. Well, we're in the second half of April, and the Connecticut State Legislature is starting to do its thing, and you're starting to see the ramp up in the presidential races as well. Trump is, of course, falling asleep in court nearly every day, while Joe Biden is barnstorming country and bringing his message out to states, frankly, that aren't Connecticut. We're going to have opportunities for you to help in Pennsylvania and New Hampshire if you want to volunteer with CT Dems. We'll talk a lot more about that as those opportunities fall in your lap. But right now, we want to kind of focus on local stuff. Last year was the municipal cycle, and we had municipal elections in every town in Connecticut. A little later on in the podcast, we'll be talking to newly elected Danbury Mayor Roberto Alves. But, you know, you hear these stories all the time about elections that make just a huge difference, sometimes on very, very narrow margins. What are some of the elections that sort of surprised you last time, or maybe not surprised you, but notable elections that you guys saw?
One of the biggest ones that I was thinking about was Chris Polos's election in 2022. He's from Southington, Connecticut, and lived in a pretty Republican area, wasn't an incumbent, and had only previously served on town council. But he really got out there, knocked on almost 5,300 doors to get voters, was super, super active in his campaign. And he was actually successfully elected by one vote. So that really goes to show that every single vote matters. And as a result of that, he was able to bring $5 million of money into his town for a library, advocated tirelessly for dementia patients and tax cuts for veterans. So really just shows that by getting in your car, going out and voting, you can really make a big difference in your town.
He was actually on national broadcast with Chris Murphy sat down with him on Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. I'm going to play a little bit of audio from that, from when he was on that show and talking about getting out there to knock on doors.
You know, it's tough to motivate to get out of your house to get to that first door. But once you get out there and you start knocking, you get into a rhythm. And it was it's just inspiring to talk to people and to hear their stories, to hear what keeps them up at night, and to talk to them about what their hopes are for the future.
And you're right, he did go out and knock on 5,300 doors or more. And you know what he did in January before the session started?
No, please tell me.
He went out and knocked on doors. Could not believe it. Like, man, this guy is the king of the door knockers.
Yeah, he seems really in touch with his constituency. And I think that's really what secured him his position, which is really admirable, I think. Definitely a lot of hard work. I hope his knuckles are okay.
Danny, you've won a few elections.
I have, yes. I have won two elections of mine, and I have ran a couple election or campaigns here in London. And I think while we're talking about notable elections, I do want to point out Mayor Alves in Danbury. I think that was one election that I focused on a lot of my time. Seeing him be a one-term mayor, a Republican mayor, by 463 votes. And then, you know, really being intertwined with his community and his constituents and really hearing what they wanted to see with new leadership. You know, not all towns are ran or led by Democrats, but we do tend to see a lot of Republican I guess you could say leading communities in New London switching over to Democrats because we actually really care and we want to see our communities thrive.
And then you're in your hometown in New London, right? Didn't the Democrats kind of...
Yeah, in New London, all seven Board of Ed seats are Democrats. All seven city council seats are Democrats. And our mayoral seat is a Democrat as well. So it was a blue wave. We swept the city for the second election in a row. Yes, and our state senator, Martha Marks, you know, she flipped the red seat to a blue seat, and Anthony Nolan, he's been holding on to his state legislature seat for quite some time now.
I'm a little confused by something. So you have seven Board of Ed seats. Typically, there's a cap on how many of any one party can sit on a board. Is it elected by district? Is it elected by sub-district within New London? These are at-large seats?
It's at-large seats. In New London, there is no minority or majority party rule, I guess you could say, when it comes to our council or our Board of Ed. But it's mostly Democrats that win here in New London.
We're going to switch over now to our conversation with Roberto Alves. A lot of the stuff that Dan was just referring to, Roberto talks about. We had a lovely talk. Here he is. This is the new mayor of Danbury, Roberto Alves, on Kineticrats, the CT Dems podcast. In a very close election last November, Roberto Alves became the new mayor of Danbury, and he's our guest here today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to join you. This is a tremendous honor to be here as your guest and as the mayor of the great city of Danbury.
That's right. So let's get right into it. There was a day when you were not the mayor of Danbury, and then you got sworn in and you were the mayor of Danbury, like a light switch flicked. How does that transition happen in your own mind? Like, it's identity, right? It's like who you are, and yet it's not who you were. So how does that, tell me how that goes?
That's a great question, because it was an incredible evening, the swearing in. You know, the police insisted on doing a police escort for my family because it was such a big deal in Danbury. It was 22 years of Republican Party control here, and to be the first Democrat to be able to slip the seat with a tremendous team, it was a special evening. We had, I think it was just over 500 folks at the swearing in. Incredible. We were worried that the fire marshal was going to have to shut us down because we were going to get at capacity. And you get up there. I have my mother, my family with me as I'm being sworn in by Governor Lamont. And that the sense of pride rushes over you. Feel, you know, and for me personally, a little personal moment. My father, you know, felt hopefully was, you know, watching down on us. I had lost him during the election at a relatively young age. He was only 64. And to, you know, get that almost sense of the weight off your shoulders, the pressures of the election. And then, like you said, that light switch, you go from being Roberto to Mr. Mayor, and everywhere you go, and me telling folks, oh, no, it's just Roberto. And then the team around, like, no, you're mayor now. People have to call you mayor. It was just an incredible feeling. And it's only been 4 months, really. So we're still getting used to certain aspects of that. But there is a lot of work that needed to be done in this city, and I was aware of that. Don't let those moments, you know, get to you too much. I try to step back sometimes and appreciate where I'm at and how hard, you know, we fought to be here, and just soak it in. But there's so much work to do. And that's what I'm here to do. I came here to work.
You can bask in it maybe for an hour, but then you're right. You got to get right into it. And I'm sure one of the first things you think about is budgeting, right? It's an essential part of the governor's role. It's an essential part of every mayor and first selectman's role. And I don't know in Danbury how it works, like when you have to put that forward, but you have to start putting together a budget to put forward as your proposal and then begin the negotiation process. So what did you encounter? Like, what did you realize once you started that oh boy, here's where two things are kind of pulling at each other, and then you're hearing from constituents and you're hearing from people and you know what you want to do, but maybe there's some limitations on doing everything you want to do.
Well, incredible, right? I mean, you win, there's an election in the first week of November, and in Danbury, we take office the first working day of December, so there's not that much time for a transition. And just like any other organization, you come in and you want to learn. Talk to as many people as you can. I had meetings set with every department head one-on-one. I presented them with a few things I wanted. I had everybody create a presentation deck for me. We talked about areas of opportunity, constraints they may have in the departments. I wanted to learn from them. And through these one-on-one meetings, well, you know, one thing that really stood out to me was it had been just about 3 years in this city since there was a department head meeting where you had people meeting collectively. And that's no way to run any organization, any entity, government or not. Like, so we established these meetings. You know, I come from corporate America. Not that there's that much difference, but, you know, there's a little bit more thought you do in government. But the operations of a city, there's a lot of those efficiencies that you do see in the private sector that I wanted to bring in. And with that and meeting those department heads, you learn. And one of the things that stood out to me were the constraints that so many departments have been under, working on shoestring budgets and being so overworked. You know, I use the word efficiency a lot. Some folks use the word efficiency and finding efficiencies in finding some excuse to downsize. And you can downsize to the point of inefficiency. And I feel like that's where the city of Danbury is at. Here we are, a city of over 87,000 folks, the seventh largest city in Connecticut. Our legal team in-house here at City Hall is 2.5 attorneys, which is embarrassingly low, woefully low. You look at a community like Waterbury, a little bit bigger than ours, they have, I believe, 16 attorneys. You look at Norwalk, which is only population-wise bigger than us by about 5,000 residents, and they have what I believe is a dozen attorneys. So our lawyers were overworked. We were outsourcing a lot of the work, paying a lot, top dollar. So the budget process, I'm trying to right some of these wrongs, but I have 20 years that we're going up against here. And we can't fix 20 years of challenges or areas of opportunity overnight. We have to be responsible for our residents. So I prioritized. I took all those those department briefings I had, you know, met with my team, read them cover to cover multiple times, more meetings. And then you play out a budget based on what we prioritized to move this city forward so people can get out of it under that weight that they felt that had been put on them over the last few years so we can better serve our residents.
Your victory was not a landslide, right? You had a narrow loss 2 years ago and then a narrow victory now. Does that inform kind of how you approach this? Or are you sort of always mindful that, like, you know, I don't have a huge mandate necessarily. Yeah. I got to earn that mandate.
I think depends on the definition of a narrow. We won by more than double than what we lost by.
Right.
In 21. Yes, I lost. It was a close election, but it was the closest election they've had in 20 years. Here I am. And for those who have, I've been interviewed on this podcast years ago, and anybody who knows the story here, I grew up in this town, city, since, and I've been here since I was five, but I only became a citizen in 2017. When you have one party control, you find a lot of towns that you have, you know, certain last names are predominant in politics, certain families. I didn't come from that world, and I came in the close election against a very prominent name in our community. Mm-hmm. And it was a wake-up call for the other party, I believe, at that time. When we came back and we doubled the victory, I beat an incumbent. I beat an incumbent with old Danbury last name. So we felt it was a big win. But not only was it just for me in the mayor's office, we swept across the board. We went from having minority representation on our city council. There was at one time the last 3 years, we only had 4 Democrats, and we have 21 city council folks. And to have 4 out of 21 be Democrats one term, and more often than not, it's always just been 6. We flipped and got 17 seats. We have a super majority. And that is a mandate, in our opinion, when you come in and you can flip a city's political trajectory like that in one election. But I am, you know, fiscally responsible. There's a lot of things I want to do here for our community, but I'm very well aware that this is a conversation maybe for another pod that I'd love to be a part of this one, talk about the regressive forms of property taxing and how we are, you know, handcuffed in a sense on how we do certain things in our city. And I'm very cognizant of that. We need to put more money in our schools. We need to put more money into the operation of City Hall, but we can't do it in the backs of our taxpayers overnight. And then when you do that, you hurt the very residents I'm trying to help. When over 50% of Danbury falls under United Way's ALIS report, asset limited, income constrained, but employed, who are, you know, paycheck to paycheck, one accident away from a real scary situation, we have to be cognizant of that as mayors. So we have to be fiscally responsible. There's so much I want to do, and it's conflicting, right? Because you want to help everybody, but you do so responsibly.
I guess, you know, growth is one way out of it, one thing you're looking for, and that's going to require housing. Housing is sort of top of everyone's mind, or at least top of a lot of people's mind around the country. And we hear it in the state capitol, we hear it in Washington, and we hear it in our cities and towns here. How are you approaching the need for housing? First of all, do you think there is a need for more housing in Danbury? And if so, I'm sort of assuming you do. And if so, how are you approaching getting more housing built?
No, a great question. Like you said, I do believe there's a high housing crisis in our state. We have people coming in. We need places for people to live so our economy can grow. And one way to manage growth in a town and responsibly budget is to encourage development so that way you don't have to increase taxes on your residents. But it's a catch-22 because, you know, you'll have in the communities, you know, you think of our cities, there's folks who think we've grown enough. There's no more room to grow. That's not sustainable either. Personally, I feel that there is room for us to grow responsibly. What are we doing? Well, we're meeting hand in hand with developers. We're trying to figure out how we can cut some of the government and bureaucratic red tape that they've been facing. Again, that's my private sector experience coming in to manage this certain aspects of this more like a business. We want to change cultures around municipal government. One of the lines I say, at the end of the day, municipal government is customer service. And we got to make sure we can service the customer. We want to remove cultures of no to cultures of yes. How can we work together? And the developers in this area, I see, are really appreciating that approach, the tenacity we brought in, how hard we're working. Other things we're doing, just haven't been viewed in a long time, is reviewing all our zoning rules and regulations. Is zoning restricting responsible growth? Like here we have a downtown that has just been, you know, neglected or forgotten about for the last 20 years, but where we can, you know, really create a hub based around transportation-oriented development to certainly invest and encourage that growth, again, responsibly. You're going to have not fill your school systems. We want young professionals in here because we have one of the fastest growing school systems in the state that are overburdened, but we can bring in these young professionals. What have we done? After I won, now, you know, the city government was a little bit more willing to speak to me at that point because I was mayor-elect. You know, I was asking questions about downtown development because it seemed like for the last 10 years, every election, every 2 years here, folks were talking about developing our downtown. So I wanted to get to the real, well, why hasn't this been happening? You know, the administration was here before. We'll talk about it every 2 years, but they've been here. Why didn't they do it? What am I missing that we haven't seen there in campaigns? Well, I learned through, you know, folks working in the city that they didn't even do the basic things you need to get going to show developers you're serious, which is the things you don't even see is what's happening on the ground. We didn't have a sewer capacity study. So if folks wanted to develop, and we had folks in line that wanted to develop really nice housing project, like housing development here, but they didn't know what our sewers could handle or not because the city hadn't done the research. So on my first week in office, we identified money at no additional cost to the taxpayer. We contracted out and we have the sewer capacity study going. I mean, we contracted out the first week I was in office in December. That study started just a few weeks ago because it couldn't start till the spring so we can have consistent rainfall to see how other water affects our system. But developers saw that because they've been waiting on this for years and they were, you know, not just eagerly anticipating, you know, the results. They were excited that, you know, we rolled up our sleeves and got to work because that's what it takes. And I want to show them that the city of Danbury, my administration, is all in on assisting this because we do need more housing. And if other places are hesitant on it, we're not because we're doing so responsibly to, you know, make sure we plan for increase in public safety that's needed. And my budget this year has an 8% increase of public safety. And we're bringing on more officers because, you know, our communities want to feel safe. We want to support our police. We want good police and we want to support them. We are going to do traffic studies. We're working on all the things that folks get concerned about when you hear housing. Address that. Have conversations, David. Conversations like this on a podcast is one way to do it. So again, it's just about open communication and the folks who are against, they'll come on board.
You talked in your answer there, you mentioned the Danbury schools. You know, just a little factoid for our listeners, Danbury High School actually has the largest enrollment, I think, of any high school anywhere in the state. You've made some improvements there too. You want to take a minute and toot your own horn here? Or you want me to I got a horn here I can toot for you if you want.
Yeah, there you go. This is where the sound effects come in, right?
That's right. I teed it up.
We have the largest high school in the state of Connecticut. We have the largest population in one single building for a high school in the state of Connecticut. Right. And then there's other, you know, factors at play that make, you know, educating our students a little bit more challenging. We have the highest percentage of multi-language learners also in the state of Connecticut.
Is that right?
And when you look at percentage-wise, when you look at actual numbers-wise, we have more individuals than I believe in Waterbury, significant larger population than us.
Really?
People want to be here. They want to live here. Just yesterday, another fun fact, Wallet Hub released their diversity rankings for cities, and Danbury's the 10th most diverse city in the country. You know, we have over 50 languages spoken here. It's an incredible city. I welcome everybody to come visit. Call me. I'll walk downtown with you. You can see everything we have. And for the last 20 years, we felt that our education system has been just neglected. We're going to make some hard decisions this year because we can't fix these problems overnight. We've been ranked dead last in per pupil expenditure for the last few decades. But we did the largest increase dollar for dollar historically in Danbury at one time from the city side, along with increases in ECS funding from the state. We've been lobbying and advocating for our schools for a long time. There's an annex building to our high school that's in the Danbury Career Academy, Danbury High School West, that we're building that's going to house another about 1,200 students. We are going to be the first district in the state that's going to change our high school model to a career academy model, where kids are going to be, you know, trapped into career pathways so they can find jobs out of school or continue their education through college. Think about things like engineering, law, business, health services, green energy. Freshman year, they come in, they get to work with all the academies. By sophomore year, they make a choice. They still have that American public general education throughout their high school, but now they're also put in a pathway so they can learn more and even, may possibly even leave with associate's degrees and things like that. And we are so excited about that project. This is a, it was a team effort. So that's been going on for many years, but we've been advocating for that for a long time and proud to see that into fruition.
How do you, the state and federal partners kind of work with you when you're making these transitions, whether it's transportation, whether it's education, whether it's, I mean, there's so many areas where if I'm just, you know, a citizen and I want to see these changes made, I don't necessarily know what happens at what level. And yet there needs to be some coordination or common, everybody rowing in the same direction. How, explain to me how that, how you finding that works or where it doesn't work.
Well, the wheels of government turn slow. And again, this is where I, you know, keep bringing that private sector where we used to think moving fast, and I'm working on speeding them up. But I have great partners here in the 5th Congressional. We have Congresswoman John Hayes, who has not only been an incredible friend, she's been just an amazing partner. And she wants to help us succeed. Through her, we were able to get $1.6 million for our Pulse Point that we want to move our bus station down to our train station to make it a true transportation hub. So again, that's transportation-oriented development, so we can develop around this area. So she's been a tremendous partner of that. And how that works is just, you know, you pick up the phone, you schedule meetings. I was down in D.C. for the U.S. Conference of Mayors, but I didn't just, you know, keep my butt in the seat at that conference with, you know, my government affairs, Francesca Capolupo, that many listeners here know. We did an extensive and exhausting schedule for me where I was out meeting with anybody and everybody down there I could meet with. We had meetings with the senators, both Blumenthal and Murphy, who've been a tremendous help. And they're there with the Connecticut delegation of mayors, myself, Mayor Rudin, Mayor Simmons out of Stanford, Mayor Paul out of Waterbury, advocating for our cities and building that partnership. So you work hand in hand, and especially with the state government too. We have a 4-day work week in Danbury. City Hall is closed on Fridays. I am almost here every Friday. I think since I've been here, I've only not come into the office one Friday. Two Fridays. But that's because I had stuff going on all day in the year, but I was still mayoring around the city. Mayoring, let's find out what the proper term, right? Mayoring around the city. But I try to go up to Hartford as much as I can on those days that I'm not in the city, so I can work with our Hartford partners. I meet with the Speaker of the House. I've met with the Majority Leader. I've met with the Senate President. I've met with the Governor. I've met with the Lieutenant Governor. I had lunch with the Comptroller the other day. I'm constantly telling Danbury's story to get these partnerships here. And for the public, what we do is we let them know. Right? We have to talk to them, and you find different means. Is in a podcast interview, is a social media post. What I found that has worked is everything and anything. We created a mayoral newsletter that we put out every month, and we bring out to local diners and put right at the diners next to their newspapers. We email it out to an email list. We put it at senior centers. We put it everywhere, and it gets out our message. I do a live Ask the Mayor every Monday in between 4:30 and 5:15, where we take questions that have been asked, and then we answer those questions, or, you know, we talk about certain points. I created a mayoral community advisory committee that was incredibly popular. The first 4 days where I opened it up, we had over 100 folks from the public apply to be on it. At the end of the day, we had over 200 applications that we had to narrow down. And this community advisory committee, we have it set up for them to meet 3 times, once every month. We created 7 subgroups. Those 7 subgroups we encouraged to meet multiple times in between those 3 set meetings. Immensely popular. I'm going to bring it back in the fall because it keeps people involved. And then the other thing I did, which has been very well received here, I made a commitment to have community town halls. We have 7 voting wards. I'm going to host one in every ward. I'm also working with civic clubs and cultural clubs like Ecuadorian, Italian community clubs, Portuguese community clubs that we have here. And we are hosting town hall events where I invite the city council at large for our city and then the ward representatives, bipartisan. And we are there and the public can come. They can speak. They can complain. They can just see what we have to say. But I am there and available for them and not running from any questions. And we give them the mic and they can speak freely. We already had our first town hall in our first ward. Immensely popular, well attended. Folks have never had that experience here. And the word got around that I've had folks from the private sector, like our mall, one of the biggest malls in Connecticut, definitely one of the highest sales tax payers in the state, say, we want to host one here with you. Would you do it here?
Nice.
And again, so it's just a way to be out there talking to people because, you know, and having onus. Not everybody's going to agree with everything I do, David, right? And I get that. Nobody, and that's just life. But what people want is just access to hear. Well, yeah, I don't agree with why you did this. Or how you did this, but why did you do it? And then they give me the opportunity to say it. And this is something I've always been big on. I did one term in the city council, and I know I ramble sometimes. I did one term in the city council, and that one term when I won, I led a group of new city councilmen with me to create a thing called Coffee with Your Councilman. And this is how these ideas started. And we worked with local diners. And we go, hey, I'd love to have a little part of your space on Saturday morning. I know it's your busiest time. We'll pay. We'll buy food. We'll make sure it's worth it for you so you don't lose money. But we want the community to come able to speak to us. What happened when we did that, and it was just before COVID, was that people came. But there were some tenured folks who didn't want us to do that because they said, well, Roberto, all that's going to happen is you're going to have people come and complain. And I looked at them. That's our job.
That's good.
That's my job as mayor. I want to listen to you, but I want to make government accessible to you. I don't want you to have to expect to come to City Hall. Some folks don't want to do that. I want to go to you. And that's how this was brought up. That's how we communicate with the residents and how we work with our federal delegation, our state delegation, and any other partner by going to them and telling them what we're doing.
Well, it's kind of amazing. You found a half an hour in your schedule to sit here and talk to us today. I want to thank you for that. You sound like you're busy. You sound like you got a lot going on.
We have a lot going on, but I love it. You know, like I said, not going to make everybody happy. There's days where some people are going to, no matter what I do, will never be right. But I come in early in the morning with a smile on my face. I leave at night with a smile on my face. It's just the, you know, what an incredible honor. It's the pride I have to be able to represent the city I grew up in, to somebody who grew up like I did, you know, at point my family through poverty, growing up undocumented, loving this community and getting be able to represent everybody now as its mayor is just an incredible honor. And I don't take it for granted. I'm here to work hard.
And to our listeners, do yourselves a favor, find Mayor Roberto Alves on social media, particularly on Facebook for those Facebook Lives. They are really excellent. If you want to see transparency and sort of back and forth open government in action, it's a place you can see it. And thank you for joining us here today, Roberto.
My absolute pleasure.
Sorry. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Mayor.
I appreciate it. It is an absolute pleasure to be here. Whenever you want to invite me back, I will make sure I find that time.
In part of that interview, Roberto did talk about how great Johanna Hayes has been for Danbury and helping out. And, you know, she's had a tight race last time. Talk about elections having consequences. She had a tight race last time, and this one is shaping up to be another tight race. Another great place to volunteer and pitch in and help out. It's on the Johanna Hayes race in the 5th District. But, you know, that brings us to the do-nothing Congress. Like, Republicans are currently in control. The last thing Connecticut needs to do is send a Republican to help Mike Johnson. This do-nothing Congress is really remarkable. I think they've passed something like 40 to 45 bills, and typical is in the hundreds that they've sent to the president about anything. And if you don't count post office namings, it may be even lower. Horrible.
Yeah, so I've always been kind of interested by like the difference in behavior with Republicans and Democrats when they are in power, because I feel as though Republicans have a lack of fear and kind of bending the rules to their advantage when they're presented with the opportunity. Like I'm thinking back to how Mitch McConnell would constantly change like the voting threshold in order to get what he wanted through. And I find it interesting that I feel like this time around with this set of people, Democrats, instead of taking that kind of role, they're just pushing more kind of power towards the executive branch, which I don't think is setting a very good precedent considering how much I feel like executive orders and that kind of thing have taken over Congress or the government.
When I think of it, I think of the Republican Party has changed a lot since Trump first took office in 2017 or 2016. I think that it has become a new norm for the Republican Party to really do nothing but start an uproar or cause chaos in our country. And that starts to become a problem when, Democrats who are working in our Congress are trying to push laws or push bills out there. They're not getting much support. We're just going around. We're just walking around in a circle and just touching on the same thing and not doing anything further. You know, I think that the Democrats are seeing that we're not getting anywhere. We have to push. We have to work harder. And that's where a lot of young people come into play. And a lot of young people have to get out and vote as well. But I think, you know, this is just a new norm for the Republican Party. It's just to just sit there and not do anything.
It's been frustrating. When Nancy Pelosi was a leader under Trump, right? You had sort of the reverse situation. You had Republicans with control of the Senate and the presidency and Democrats in control of the House. They passed so much stuff through the House. Now, a lot of it went to Mitch McConnell's desk and collected dust. But the fact was Democrats were moving that legislation. So, now, you know, you see Biden working on a number of things. The biggest one is a student loan forgiveness. These are existing laws that have existed since the Bush administration and all through the Obama years and through the Trump years. Some people applied for the stuff and very few got it. I think it was something like 7,000 people had the debt relief that now he's extended to hundreds of thousands of people. Just here in Connecticut, we're looking at about 16,000 people have been had their student loans discharged, and that adds up to about $890 million worth of relief just in Connecticut, where we're about 1% of the population. Do you guys know anyone who was affected by that?
Because I'm currently in college, no, everyone's in that happy phase of not worrying about student loans and all
that. I remember that phase. I was in that phase once.
It's all rainbows and sunshine here.
Same here. I mean, I'm still in that phase where, you know, I don't have to worry about that. Luckily, I'm still in school, so I have some time before I get to that point.
But I do want to kind of talk about why I think that there's a do-nothing Congress right now. And I think a really huge part of it is that the Republican Party has kind of figured out that if they continue to start kind of culture wars, they will appeal to the average MAGA voter way more than if they were to actually start doing things. Because I think MAGA voters don't actually want policy returns as much as lawmakers acting out in their preferred form of grievance-driven identity politics. That's one of my biggest suggestions for the Democratic Party is, as much as I hate to say this, I think that so much of the Democratic Party's attitudes are very technical.
We're policy wonks. We're like, but wait, right? This will totally work. It has worked. Look.
Yeah.
It also legitimately does. I mean, there's like objective, measurable change, and we see it. I mean, the biggest one is the job creation. Like, if you look at Obama, Clinton, and Biden, something like 98, 99% of all jobs created in the last 35 years have been under those three Democratic presidents.
Right.
Like, that's it. Like, the job creation just happens under Democrats.
And I think that for a lot of educated Democratic voters, like, those things make sense and they're tangible and whatever.
Right.
But nothing is as powerful as being like, these people are killing these other people and therefore you need to vote for me, or that kind of like identity-based, culture-based issue. So I think that, as much as I hate to say this, hats off to the Republicans for starting those kinds of issues, because I think that that's what's really been carrying through their successes in the past couple of years.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because I think they keep losing elections because of that. I think that's kind of what happens, certainly in Connecticut. If you look at the state, if you really look at the Stefanowski campaign and what he attempted to message, there were things that just didn't land. They just simply didn't resonate. While Ned was talking about, turning around Connecticut's economy and, of course, managing the COVID crisis. That was something nobody could have seen coming in 2018. Nobody did, and became a real test that he passed with flying colors. But it is that grievance stuff. And I see that with what Logan is doing now in the fifth. where he opened his campaign with an announcement video featuring like some deep state federal agents coming in to confiscate your stove. Okay, this is a thing that has literally never happened to a single human being. It's something that has never happened, not even once. But it has become this bugaboo on the right of like, somebody's going to come steal your gas stove. Democrats are trying to steal your gas stove. Meanwhile, you're cooking in your gas stove. Like, literally no one or any of your neighbors or relatives lost their gas stove. And yet he opened his campaign with it.
Republicans will do a lot of talking and a lot of, you know, back and forth, but they're not really appealing to the voter base, I guess you could say, appealing to the people that you want to vote for you. But Democrats, we are. And then, you know, once we're elected, we're backing up our words with our actions in our state legislatures, on our boards and Congress and the White House. You know, I think the Republicans are just going to continue to fail if they don't step up their game, which, you know, I'm okay with them losing.
So I'm going to edit my point. I'm like, I've heard enough. I understand. I will edit it to say that I think that it's been effective in igniting a very certain kind of base for Republicans. And I want to go back to the gas stove because in my global environmental politics class, my professor actually brought this up and was sharing all these articles about how terrified people were that the government was going to come into their homes and steal their gas stoves, which to me is quite frankly very, very ridiculous and kind of funny, honestly.
Before we wrap up the show, I do need to make a correction to something I misstated in the last show. This is extremely important, probably only to me and one or two of my friends that I joke with via text. Ryan Binkley, the Republican running for president who none of you have ever heard of and who both our past host and Tara believe might be fabricated. I may have made him up, but I didn't. I said that he got a huge number of votes, relatively speaking, in Killingly, Connecticut. I believe my phrase was Killingly is Binkley country. Dear listener, I regret to inform you, Killingly is not Binkley country. There must have been some bug on the New York Times website that was reporting votes, because when I went and checked, turns out Binkley got zero votes in Killingly. So my apologies, and I got that correction out of the way. It is now April. This is gonna come out on April the 18th, and that means there's only about 3 weeks left in the state legislature session. So do pay attention to what's going on up there. We'll bring you some reporting on that probably next week. You know, we talked to Christine Palm a few weeks ago. Go back and listen to that episode if you want a little background on the Climate Protection Act that's going to be going through. We've got our conventions coming up too. This is sort of a thing that parties do. You're probably familiar with the National Convention, but there's conventions for just about everything. State Senate seats, state rep seats, our members of Congress will have conventions at which they're re-endorsed for nomination, and there's a statewide convention that'll be happening on May 11th. Are you going to the state convention?
Yes, I am.
You're going to be a delegate up there?
I will.
So it's in Eastern Connecticut this time. We made your drive a little shorter.
Yes, you did. Thank you for that.
Hey, some people not too happy about it, but it's a great venue. It actually is a great venue, and we're kind of looking forward to it. Tara, you've got a little announcement to wrap up the show as well. What do we got going on at the College Dems?
I actually have two announcements. So the first one is that College Democrats of Connecticut is holding their annual convention this Saturday, April 20th, from 11 to 4 p.m. at Trinity in Hartford. Be there or be square. You can RSVP for the event through a link that we have in our Instagram, CollegeDemsCT. And then the second very exciting thing is that we now have apparel. So if you'd like to support CDCT and everything that we do, we have that link as well on our Instagram. Very cute t-shirts, sweatshirts, crewnecks with the logo cleaning up Republican messes since 1933, which in my opinion is a very funny callback to FDR's social plans following the Great Depression. So take a look at it, check it out, get involved, and come to our convention. It's fun, I promise.
Awesome. So that's going to do it for this edition of Connecticut Rats, the Seat Dems podcast. Thank you guys for joining us this week. And we'll be back shortly with more exciting news from the world of Connecticut Democratic politics.
Everyone, thank you so much.
Goodbye, everyone. Have a good week.